express the hope that everybody feels bedded down into the seminar and connected to it after yesterday. As always, particularly if you're new to seminars, there's always a time of adjustment and making connections, tuning into the level at which the seminar is operating and that sort of thing. So, you know, if time allows, probably David would take us around the room and ask if how it is with you, but I can just now express the hope that it is working well for you. I'd like to just say that I'm going to be talking this morning about determinism and free will. And I'd like to give a little bit of background as to why I proposed this topic for the seminar. There are several things. Back in my student days, I studied the book Divine Providence from Woe to Go and back again. Sat examinations in it, and at the time, of course, I thought I had a good grip of the topic. I also did quite a lot of church history in connection with university studies, and was aware of the determinist theology which emerged in the Christian church over the centuries. Having said that, I was all very theoretical about it, and I tended to leave it on one side as if it was a doctrine and a way of thinking that was long gone past and need not in one sense be given a lot of attention to. But over the last 20 years or so, I've had a rude awakening with regard to determinism or predestination and the conflict raises with regard to free will. In 1986, the Sydney Society of the New Church, now of course at Roseville, managed to buy an ex-Uniting Church that was no longer required in Shirley Road, Roseville. And there was the remnant of a congregation there, four, five, six people whose church it had been, and I had no real sense of the area or of the layout, a way of the way that part of the North Shore of Sydney thought and operated. But as we were getting to settle into that church, I decided that it was important to introduce ourselves to the neighbourhood and prepared a leaflet about the new church and our background and our history. And distributed, I think, maybe 1,000 copies or something like that in the immediate streets. And not a day or two after having done that, Ruth would remember, over the road, but just down on the corner, opposite the church, there was an elderly doctor at the time living. And he came out in a real state of turmoil and waved my newsletter at me and said what I thought was my newsletter. And he began by saying, "Well, this is why I can't stand organized religion." And I was all querulous about this. And I had a look at his newsletter and I decided, "Hey, hang on a minute, this isn't the newsletter I distributed. This is from the Anglican Church." So I said, "Hang on a minute, what are you saying?" And he says, "Can I have a look?" Well, it was, at the time, a folded foolscap, just bigger, of course, than A4. And on the back, there was an article about the new church, and it was really horrible. In fact, it was of a nature which we could have subsequently reported it to anti-discrimination, and because at the bottom of it, it had, "Parents, be aware of your children with this sect." And so I decided I couldn't leave this alone, and I went to see the vicar, rector, a man called Silas Horton. And he was stiff, formidable, unsmiling, but invited me into his study and sat me down and gave me a lecture on predestination. and he made it absolutely clear that we were damned as a group. I personally was damned, and he was predestined to heaven. And I said to him, I remember saying to him, well, what about your family? Is your mother, is your wife, are your children? No, no, he said, they're all predestined to heaven. But I can assure you that you and your group are predestined to hell. Now, he didn't even show me out of the church. He was a difficult man, but it woke me up. That was at Roseville, the vicar at Roseville. And I then came back rethinking, well, hang on a minute, is predestination or predeterminism more alive than I thought? Well, in the next year or so, with a member of the Sydney Society called Peter Black, I did a philosophy course with the University of New England. And the lecturer in philosophy at that time was a determinist. And I sat through his lectures for a semester, and we were then required to do a paper, and I decided to challenge his determinism and predestination. And I didn't hold back. I really tore into some of the things that he'd said during his lectures, and I got my paper back, which I've only destroyed in the last couple of years, and it had red comment and lines all through it. He wouldn't take on board at all an alternative view to determinism. So it's rocking around, and then just before Christmas we had a visitor coming to church from time to time in Brisbane, and it occurred to me after he had been coming five or six times that I needed to sort of sit down and talk through where he was at, because you don't get a lot of a chance after church. And I said, look, come and I'll pick you up and we'll go for coffee, which we did. And he said, well, I'm a determinist. He's from the Church of Scotland. And he said, oh, I'm a determinist. I thought, okay, you're a determinist. That was in December. Well, my son, one of our sons, who has a great interest in these sorts of affairs, he sends me, after he has read, the magazine called The Economist. And The Economist had an article in it, a review of a book in one of its December issues, which, it, by the way, is quoted. I'm going to give you copies of the notes that I've personally prepared and am using, so I'll pass these around in a while, but I don't want you to just follow them. You'll just have all the references. And that got me thinking, what with this visitor having said I'm a determinist, and then this review of the book in The Economist, I thought, So that had me. I then decided to write, some of you get our newsletter, the Brisbane newsletter, and I wrote What Makes Us What We Are, an editorial in the February-March issue, taking it up. Now, there's just one other thing I want to give you by way of background. Determinism is resurging, and it is resurging in a very strong way, and it's on the back more of genetics and that kind of thing. If you just get onto your computer and type in the words, two words, genetic determinism, it'll blow you away as to where that sort of research is leading. There is a tremendous resurgence. I'll give you a quote from just, according to genetic determinism, I'm quoting from one of the sites, we can't help being who we are or thinking and behaving as we do. That's a quote. Now that's a rough summary of you know, not everybody goes down that track, but I just want you to know that there's, because of, you know, we talk about the way our brains are wired and this kind of thing, it's leading some at least to this view that we can't help being who we are or thinking and behaving as we do. Now, I listen also to criminal cases and I get upset at times because some judgments, it seems to me, are based on the idea that physiological factors have determined people's behaviour. And I'm not always convinced. Mind you, I don't sit there as the jury and I don't know all the facts, but I'm not always comfortable when I hear these appeals to genetic factors as having determined the behaviour for which that person is being tried and often acquitted. You look at the defence cases which are put up. So determinism is rocking around in the system much, much more than we sometimes, or at least I, often and for a long time believe to be the case. There's a lot of determinism out there. It's definitely resurging and it's definitely influencing a lot of the thinking that's going on in contemporary society. Now, having said that, I would have been a person who was very staunchly on the side of what I took to be the teaching of the writings about free will. And that in all but the rare set of circumstances, we are in free will and we don't need to look for escape routes from the responsibility that free will puts on us. Now, having said that, I think that is probably too extreme. I have come back somewhat to a position which has me wondering, at what point free will genuinely kicks in. Now, for a long time, I don't believe that free will kicks in much before, genuine free will kicks in much before we're about 30. And the reason I say that is because free will, the genuine free will and the exercise of free will, in terms of spiritual consequences and accountability, I'm talking about, in terms of spiritual consequences and accountability, requires that we have owned for ourselves the truth that has been imparted to us, whether it's been by our parents, our grandparents, our aunties, or in Sunday school, or whatever. Now, you've got to stop and think about that for a while, because we operate for many years and we never in certain areas get away from operating from what we have received from our environment, that is through our parents and others around us, the examples and so on. So where the doctrines, where the writings are talking about free will, have this in mind, that you require a situation where a person has seen things and seen the truth of something which they like and are attracted to and have decided to make their very own. So that's why if you look at, you know, just by way of you know, delving into the writings, David became king when he was 30. The Lord began his public ministry when he's 30. And 30 corresponds to the fullness of remains, which is all about this capacity and ability to step outside what has been traditional and environmental with you and to begin to consider things for their own worth and according to how you see it, differently from your parents. David, in his first lecture yesterday, talked about the tension as our young people begin to grow up. All very necessary, when you stop and think about it, if they are ever going to reach the stage that they're not just mouthpieces of what their environment has imparted to them. So, when free will kicks in, that's been quite a salutary thing for me. I truly am of the view that it's rarely before 30, and it can be well into the 30s. I sat beside, many years ago, I sat beside a young man who was 36 at the time as he died, and I was there as he died. And as he died, I thought, a child has gone to heaven. A child. Although he had three children, I thought, this is a child. Mm-hmm. He hadn't really, because I'd known him since he was about 16 or 17, and I thought, yes, there's a child gone to heaven. So, yes, when free will kicks in, and the circumstances under which free will kicks in, and also the circumstances which modify our opportunities to exercise free will. All of this sort of thing is in my mind in putting up my hand for this subject of determinism and free will. Is it just one other thing I wanted to say? I still get for years, the Seventh-day Adventist Church has been sending around a magazine called Ministry. Do you get it, Glenn?
I used to.
Yes. Fortunately,
it moved too often.
Yes. I send them my changes of address, and sometimes I don't read an issue. Other times I find some really splendid material in it. But this is the very latest, May 2012, which came, we talk about stream of providence and so on. What could I have wanted more than a subject on free will and choice? And again, it is reflecting the intensity of the debate that is current. This is not medieval Reformation time stuff. This is current stuff challenging determinist thinking within the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which surprised me. So that's May 2012. Free will and choice, a study of Jeremiah 1 verse 5. Now there are two passages in the Bible which are cited by determinists or predeterminists. Jeremiah 1 verse 5, and the other one is in Psalm 139, which we referred to yesterday, where it says something along the lines that from my mother's womb thou hast known me and formed me. So that's issues. Now, I'd like to say a couple of other things with regard to determinism, but in the meantime, let me just start to pass these around, because just occasionally, as I said, don't read them, but occasionally I'm going to refer you to notes or points I've made, or I'm making.
Excuse me, in regards to genetic determinism, the people supporting that idea that we are fixed because of our genes, not our scientists?
Yes. And medical researchers and that area. Possibly, Brian, you know more about it than I do, but I've only got mine from looking up and reading the sites on the computer. Just type in genetic determinism, whoop!
That's very surprising, because in the new biology, it's now scientifically recognised that our mind actually determines which genes come into effect or not.
Well, it's very, very interesting.
So I'm a bit interested, Ian, in, because I know that Swinburne talks about the rationality having to be in place before we can be, actually have free will, which doesn't kick in until about 24 or so. So you say that sometimes it takes quite a long time before people actually grow into that, even beyond 24.
It does. I'm convinced it can be. I'm convinced that some people are well into their 30s. I'm convinced that some people may almost go through life childlike.
Yes. Yeah.
I really am. Mm.
I picked up on this only about a month ago. Because of this, I started to have a different view towards, you know, my teenage son. And that, you know, and putting more of a responsibility on myself for you know, protecting him, instead of saying, well, you know, you're responsible for my life.
Even we who can hope that we have our free will, let me just say this, two things. First of all, we are not free all the time, nor are we free we're not free all the time, and in some areas of our life we're not free at all. We are creatures or outcomes of habits which we've not revisited, and maybe the Lord doesn't see any need for us to revisit, but there is determinism running through us all. So be aware of that. And you see, free will, you know, we think that every waking moment we are in free will. Not at all. Not at all. Free will is something we move into and move out of, according as the Lord sees the need for it. A lot of time we're operating on automatic pilot. And so that's another thing about free will. Just on that point for a moment, I just want to talk about accountability. You hear me all right, John?
Yes.
About accountability. Spiritual accountability, it's a little bit of a sidetrack, but it's worth it. There are always two things that must be present for accountability. One is your will must be involved, and the other is your understanding must be involved. Now that's important, because many things can be done from the will without the understanding. Some things can be done with the understanding, but not with the will. I'll give you an example. Dr. Friedemann Horn, who was the New Church Minister in Zurich for many, many years, and published, because he had his own printing press, most of the copies of the writings which are available in German, he was a Nazi soldier. And it was a tremendous burden for him, but he shot prisoners of war, and he came to Manchester for an international conference that the college staged, and he bared his soul about what this was meant for him. But he was in a terrible situation where he had a gun trained on him as he had a gun trained on prisoners of war. Now, you can argue what you might have done, but he shot prisoners. He did it, in other words, from one side, but not from the other. So you can do things from the understanding, but not from the will. You can do things from the will and not from the understanding. Now, I've given you a number. In true Christian religion, it unquestionably says you can do things from the will, out of passion, and the Lord allows for it and understands it and works with it. Okay? There's a passage in my 1951 translation of True Christian Religion. I think I've quoted a more recent one in the notes I've given you. It talks about what is overpowering. And that also I picked up in another article of this is a more recent edition of this is March the 31st to April the 6th of The Economist, where talking here about the psychology of morality, a simple experiment suggests a way to encourage truthfulness, and it says here that is sin original? That's the question addressed by a psychologist at the University of Amsterdam, etc., etc., and they decided to put people under pressure in an experimental situation. And without time for without time for reflection, people will default to the mode labelled cheat. In other words, the first impulse is to cheat or to lie. And given time, it says, given such time, however, they will often do the right thing. If you want somebody to be honest, then do not press him too hard for an immediate decision. In other words, let the passion or whatever that's arisen, let that be the determining answer that you might be seeking from. Anyway, that's about.
Is that in the notes?
I'm not sure, but it's yes. Is it there? You found it? Good. Thank you. So I want to now just turn to, because I'm linking this in with the book Divine Providence. Put a couple on. I want to have a look at where the writings say that our free will is compromised. And this, as I say, ties us back into the book Divine Providence. And on this, you don't need me to write too much on the blackboard, but towards the bottom of page 2, determinism is all about what is caused by others and involves factors that deny us the exercise of our free will. This, in fact, takes us into the chapter in Divine Providence, into the law of the Divine Providence, quote, that we should not be compelled by outside forces to think and intend and so to believe and love in matters of our religion, but that we should guide ourselves and sometimes compel ourselves. And so you have it that no one is reformed by miracles and signs because they compel, by visions or conversations with the dead, by threats or by punishments in states where freedom and rationality are absent. And I've asked the question, what might those states be where freedom and rationality are absent? And I've offered, not comprehensively, but I've offered some thoughts on that. Undue dependent friendship can be a state where your free will is compromised. Highly charged emotional situations. How many people came forward or come forward in the likes of the Billy Graham Crusades in highly charged emotional circumstances and make a decision for Christ but then fall away from it? So highly charged emotional situations can put people under a state of compulsion and compromise their free will. It's not a considered decision. Immaturity, we've talked about. Ethnic mindsets compromise our free will. You think about that, the way people have been brought up or culturally to think and approach things. I remember sitting in a barber's chair in Gordon once, and I looked across at another man having a haircut, and it was one of the soccer coaches who I knew because our boys were doing soccer. His face was all lacerated and stitches across his chin. I said, my goodness me, whatever's happened? He said, well, I took my team out, the under-16s, and we were playing, I have to tell you, a Serbian team or something like that. And he said there was a disputed goal and they raced to their cars and got the bike chains and landed into us all. Coach and all. But what I'm getting at is an extreme example of how sport is seen almost as a war and not as a game. And they can't see it otherwise. It's not a game unless they've got their cars with the bike chains in it and things like that. That's the truth. Yeah. He's sitting there with his face all cut up.
What's it about the bloke who's being tried now? Muddish.
Yeah.
Is he now got a defence to say, sorry, I'm so heavily imbued with an ethnic mindset, I'm not responsible?
I'm going to come to this, mate, because whilst I see the impact of situations which compromise our free will, I tend to the view, Helmut, that the Lord offers us enough examples of alternatives to provide the basis for us exercising free will. But when you've got a group of 16-year-olds who are nowhere near thinking independently for themselves, but are into a mob mentality, then they have not got free will. And so they all race like a mob into their the cars that brought them and go bashing up the other team. So it's one thing to talk about minors who have not yet been exposed sufficiently to the alternative behaviours that would be, like I say, the basis of them exercising free will, as to be looking at somebody who's into their adulthood and has enough exposure for to know that that behaviour doesn't always apply at soccer fields. So that's yes, Glenn.
And wouldn't you say that it would be appropriate to make judgments based on civil or universally accepted law or principles, where the individual, you know, might well be acquitted in the next life because he doesn't personally attach himself to those things, but that because we live in the natural world, we need to enforce standards of behavior and continually move our society, including our ethnic minorities, in the direction of better morality.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for that. And Helmut, just one other thing. The culpability for that behavior lay with the adults and the coach, because we're talking about under 16s and they have coaches who are 30, and the man I'm talking about sitting in the barber's chair was 40, same age as I was at the time. So there's where the culpability, that he doesn't use his coaching time or time with his players to at least lay down the required manner in which the game is played. The kids themselves, well, they all need a clip around the ear for it afterwards, but I don't see them being spiritually accountable. I see them caught up in a mob thing where their free will, such as it is no longer there.
I mean, is it, you know, if in a situation, if nothing counters that situation for you mentally at the time, then you're not in freedom because you haven't been given the choice. Then afterwards, if you look at the situation and you see that it was wrong, internally I'm talking about, you actually perceive it and then you justify what you... So there is a point of choice because you are aware of an alternative. That
it's interesting you say that because I don't think Margaret will mind me mentioning it, but last week she'll got more courage than I have when it comes to this, but she went up to the shopping centre and parked, and she saw a couple parking in one of the bays for mothers with children. And she went up and said, look, you know, you really shouldn't be parked there. Mind your own BF and business, this sort of thing. But he waited in the shopping centre, you know, how many minutes later, and found Margaret and apologised. So that's exactly what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah. That having... So external societal law has to still judge the behaviour.
Yes.
But in terms of that person's actual freedom at the time, that's a whole different question, which can only be worked out spiritually.
Well, we all have that, don't we? We're emotionally overwhelmed. And give in to, you know, what do you call it, temptation? That's a different matter, but, you know, you're overwhelmed. And you just follow that. You're in that moment, and then it's not until that settles, the water settles, that you go, yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
well,
I
often, in logo practice, you know, that the, you know, because a lot of the work you do is after the fact, but there's no time and space in the spiritual world. So, if you are presented with something after a behaviour, you know, if you're presented with the, you know, your own motivations or some insight after the behaviour, then it's not too late to be working on it because there's no time and space, and actually, so the whole concept of redemption and that and what have you is just an interesting,
very, very, very interesting one. Yes.
One of the things you haven't put down here is 4 months. I would have thought that would
be. had we had the time, I was going to throw it open at that point, yeah. Ruth. I appreciate that I, just preparing my notes, I just ran for you. I was, dare I say it, better not.
Watch out.
Yeah, I was going to put PMT down.
Teenage testosterone.
Yes.
Or menopause.
Yeah. And to bring balance to this, if I take these slings and arrows for you,
yes.
I think if we're going to accept menopause and hormones and things, we have to accept the male flu. Because when we get sick, we experience it much worse than they do. It's been proven now. And they need to look after us. That's a proof for each, you know what I mean? Yes, see, it's beyond us. We're sick. We haven't had any free will, have we, mate? In the male flu, we're just sick.
Oh, Lorraine doesn't agree with it. Go ahead. What I've read about genetic reasons for behaviour, it's all in the genes, summed up with, it's in the genes. Virtually all of that is not programmed. People say it, but there's no hard evidence that these behaviours can be traced back to your genetic makeup. And now it's a big.
Exactly. The opposite is proven.
Yeah.
In neurobiology, and it's that the genes, women now, you've heard, you get these, current affairs or some program like that, and you've got, women are three generations of breast cancer, and so you get the 18 or 25-year-olds already going to the doctor surgically to get their breast removed because, they're going to get breast cancer. Well, it's not proven, that will happen. There's an increased percentage with physical performance, but certainly with most of it, there is no predetermination that it will happen. And it is, it's coatings of, around those genes, the DNA, the RNA, and what actually decides whether this change or actually something that kicks in is actually the mind gets involved. That's scientifically proven now.
Is that okay?
Yeah. Can I just say, look, both things are true. And any time we try and say, science proves this, I think we're breaking something because we need to hold that probably there'll be other science over here that doesn't as well. It's science just one way of trying to get at truth, And one of the best studies with DNA is where they've studies done of monozygotic twins raised apart, so their genetic DNA is identical, and in cases like that, there's twins where both twins, for example, might get intellectual disability, so it hasn't been the environment 100%. But with schizophrenia, for example, 50% of the twins raised apart both get schizophrenia, but another 50% only one does, which is telling us it's then a predisposition. It's not, the genetic makeup isn't saying you've got it, there it is. It's more like, high blood pressure or diabetes or something. You've got a predisposition, but your environment affects it. But even in cases where, and this has been back in your point, because both these things are true, in cases where there is a full-on genetic marker like intellectual disability, there's a lovely study done with these two twins, boy and a girl with intellectual disability in America, who were in a large hospital setting, and they measured their IQ and it was about 50. And then they were put into a lovely little country setting, country hospital. Because they were young kids, everybody looked after them and loved them. And their IQ jumped about 20 or 30 points from memory. so that the environment actually, so it, there's a whole lot, you know, research is always trying to tease out not an absolute truth, you know, and yeah, anyway, it's not, I'm talking too much, but that, you know,
that's helpful. Thank you. Can I just get you to turn to addiction, which I know there's two people who are experts in this room, who are Patrick and also Brian. But I said here, whilst the jury is still out for me with regard to this, I read once that in all likelihood every one of us is addicted to something. Drugs and alcohol and tobacco are, of course, the most readily accepted as such, but what might you also add to this list? I'm talking about what compromises our free will and therefore leaves us, as it were, determined and driven rather than having chosen the outcomes and actions. Self-image, success, work, sport, hobbies, pornography, of course. Now, that's another area where, you know, people do get driven by their behaviour, but a bit like David, when you said about time to think afterwards and that sort of thing. I mean, I have worked alongside drug addiction in Brisbane, and I do know that that is not a relentless state. I know the addiction continues, but I know that the drug-induced behaviour and state is not relentless day after day, month after month. I've said these can become obsessions or even compulsions. Is there then room for free will still? So I wrote in that little editorial in Breaking Bread, externally it can seem indeed that we're not in freedom but are driven by our compulsions, genetically based and maybe even environmentally induced as these can be. What intrigues me is what is yet again held up to us in our church's teachings about it being an eternal law that everyone should be interiorly in freedom. One of the things this is saying to me is that notwithstanding compulsions, they can't determine what we think and feel about them. We can still stand apart from them and make observations and decisions about them, even if we continue to be held enthralled and by them. And my experience in Brisbane is of terrible behaviour, violent, abusive. I've seen it all, I've been there, I've stood in front of it, I've felt threatened by it, and yet I've had phone calls from the same person a few days after, weeping, self-loathing, hatefulness about themselves because of it all. So I defer to the likes of Patrick and Brian, of course, but I just wanted to say that my experience is much behind that comment I made, that there seem to be breaks when there's some observation of the type of behaviour that they've indulged.
Yes.
I think for me it's about our spiritual associations. So, you know, as Brian was saying last night, we're in this incredibly, as to the life of our minds and our inner world, we're in this incredibly dynamic environment and incredibly dynamic and changing spiritual associations that are stronger in different places for other people. And in terms of free will, I think it really comes back to our understanding of truth at that time.
Yeah.
And the ability for truth, for divine truth, to pierce that cloud, that, you know, erupting cloud of different spiritual associations. Because that will take, that the drugs, for example, that'll be very incredibly strong at some point, and it will pull us down to a certain point where insight will be gained, and then a shift can occur in the spiritual associations.
Yes.
And we can work back, but then they're always there, and they can grab us and they can pull us back down again. So it's just, it's interesting after Brian's talk. I just thought about, you know, what we look like in terms of where we are in the spiritual world, and it's massive and it's dynamic and it's like a hurricane almost.
Yeah. Thanks. Now I want to just wrap this up now by coming to the bottom of page 4. And I've said here, with regard to no one is reformed in states where freedom and rationality are absent, Divine Providence 138 reads, there are many states that lack freedom and rationality, but generally they are assigned to the following categories: states of fear, emergency, mental illness, serious physical illness, ignorance, and intellectual blindness. My comment is, illnesses are identified, such as were never known about a generation or two ago. I have in recent years come to wonder if in fact there are not a greater number of people who do not and cannot exercise free will than I had previously supposed.
Yes.
And that has made me, I think, a lot more merciful when I'm dealing with people's behaviour, wondering if they're even something undiagnosed.
I think that's so beautiful. I remember reading that very early on in, because for me it's important that what's in the writings confirm what I experience psychologically and physically, that, that they don't rupture each other. And when I read that, I was really touched by that, because I haven't worked with people when they're psychotic. It's a movement between, like, exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. There's
a when you get really ill, you know, when you're in a lot of pain, you know, your free will just starts to fade. Because, but I was thinking, as you've been talking this morning, I mean, the body's set up like that anyway. You know, there's an autonomic nervous system that looks after our blood temperature and all the other things which we're not in control of. And then there's the things we can move, like our hands. So our whole body's set up in between willing and non-willing aspects. And that shifts. I mean, your blinking and your breathing are autonomic, but you can control them like that if you want to, but you wouldn't want to keep doing it, because then you'd be in charge of your blinking all day long. It would drive you around the twist, you know. And you can do biofeedback to learn to control blood flow and stuff. But again, you know, if you do that, you know, you wouldn't have time to think, because you'd be trying to manage all the stuff in your body, which the cerebrum's looking after through divine influx. And so I really love what you're saying, because I think if you're working with someone that's dependent, you're helping them move in a space between, or even when they're psychotic, between, okay, that's that, I support you, what happens if you can move here? And I think that's what makes this, like what you're saying, Patrick, not just an individual process, but the people around you can help give you more free will if they support you, you know? And that's what I really like. And if you get yourself to the right sphere, in the right place, your free will would increase, not just to you, but because of where you are, you know? Which is why we have societies and people that you're drawn to in heaven, where you're, you know, connected to and supported. You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
One other thing also I'd like to say is that I a little bit speculative, but I think that people for whom handicap or illness is a permanent state, I find myself reflecting on their access to their free will, just by the way,
Or another way of saying it, rather than black or white, pregnant or not pregnant, you can sort of say their free will is so minuscule on that balance, the determinism is so strong, you need to sort of move the determinism to the middle a bit and give the free will more leverage. It's like that moving, you've got to move stuff around.
I want to end on this point, because what I'm appealing to, just this last week, I've been following up somebody who's been mightily hurt, Daniel Glenn, and he's a severely handicapped person, but he is struggling with the whole thing of forgiveness towards him. So I spent some time preparing some stuff and sending it to him during the week. And what I just want to end with is, I'm appealing to you to bring back into focus this relationship between determinism and free will when you're dealing with people, and don't be so quick to jump to certainty that they've acted out of considered place out of free will.
Yes.
There are such a number of varieties, such a range of varieties of state that people can be in. They can be acting under compulsion, actually,
yes.
But we judge them as on the basis that this is a considered thing and I'll never speak to you again kind of thing. And what this has done, it's the whole thing for me has just made me much more flexible when it comes to the issues of free will and determinism. I'm seeing determinism much more at play in people's behaviour and in my own behaviour. And once again, I'm referring to the book Proving God, which I was reading earlier this year. And it brought home to me just how much of life which is predetermined. And I'll leave you with a tease. You are predetermined insofar as your place in the grand man is concerned. That's a coffee. Mm-hmm.